As a content warning, this episode contains a discussion of the imprisonment of Japanese Americans during World War II. It includes recordings of the personal testimony of those placed in concentration camps. I think it's important to hear their stories with as little censorship as possible, in an effort to capture some semblance of what those imprisoned experienced. However, if hearing these stories will cause you distress for whatever reason, I acknowledge this and would suggest that you come back and listen next week. Welcome to Lost and Found, where we challenge the idea that only winners write history by highlighting losers from the past. This week, we're going back in time about 80 years to discuss the imprisonment of Japanese Americans in concentration camps during World War II. If you're wondering why I'm using language like imprisonment and concentration camps, we'll get to that later. I acknowledge that Japanese Americans were not the only demographic placed in camps during the war. The omission is intentional. You might think, on a podcast which generally tries to unearth untold stories, that I would focus on German-American or Italian-American prisoners. Maybe another time I'll do that. However, this week centers Japanese-Americans precisely because they're the most frequently discussed in the context of World War II camps. I can explain this in two ways. First, some historical losers are discussed a lot, but can never really be discussed enough. We need to keep telling and amplifying their stories, both because it's unjust on face to ignore them, and because, to cite a saying that's cliche because it's true, we need to study history to avoid repeating it. Second, some historical losers are discussed a lot, but they're discussed predominantly in the third person, ignoring the existence of substantial personal testimony about their experiences. I think both of these claims are true with respect to Japanese Americans imprisoned during World War II. As such, all of the content of this episode, aside from this intro and some transitions done by me, will be comprised of personal testimony from Japanese American prisoners. The source material will be a combination of recorded interviews, which are openly available on YouTube but don't have nearly enough views, and written testimony. For the written testimony, I will be reading it out loud, only because there is no other way to get it across in this medium. Recorded interview credits go to Studies Weekly. My apologies for the music behind these interviews. I wish they would just let them talk. But it is what it is. Written testimony was compiled by the American Friends Service Committee's Oral History Project. They have a quite remarkable 200-plus page collection of transcribed interviews on their website, which I encourage all listeners to go and check out. The first interview is from a man named Samuel Mahara. I will let him explain his background.
I came from San Francisco. I entered Heart Mountain at the age of 9. And I was here for 3 years. I left at the age of 12. We got on a train and then rode the train for 4 days, 3 nights. Each of us were carrying our one suitcase. Unfortunately, they never told us we were coming to Wyoming, and so it was difficult packing. We didn't know what clothes to bring, and it turns out that was a huge mistake because that winter was awful. It was very, very cold and windy. We saw the barbed wire fences, the guard towers along the perimeter, the armed guards inside the towers, and the floodlights. And there were signs along the perimeter, along the fence line, in both English and Japanese, warning us, do not cross this line, this fence, and that is a definition of a prison, because anyone inside the enclosure, if they feel they're going to be shot and hurt if they try to cross and go outside, then we are truly prisoners. What was the crime that we were accused of? And the answer is there was none. Later on, there was an intensive study as to why this happened, and it was quite obvious that the reasons included the racial hatred, the hysteria that existed in the West Coast at the time, the leaders who failed us to honor the Constitution. The government tried to deliver the message to us that it was our duty to participate in this activity as an act of loyalty to the government, and by doing so and by not complaining, we were showing our allegiance to the U.S., which is obviously and totally false, that we don't have to accept imprisonment to show that we have allegiance to the U.S. The original plan was to build grammar schools in the camp. There were complaints from people outside the camp saying that it's not correct to build new schools for prisoners when the people outside the camp don't have new schools themselves. And so they urged the government stop building schools. All of the grammar schools were stopped, and so there were no grammar schools to be finished. We converted some of the barracks into grammar schools.
Now, a second portion of his interview.
I'm frequently asked about differences in different style of camps around the world, and the 10 camps in the U.S. All had the same characteristic of being prison-like. Barbed wire fences, guard towers, weapons, making sure that we don't escape. That is common with all of the, quote, concentration camps and similar camps around the world. Throughout the first year, we were under heavy guard, and no one, absolutely no one, tried to get even close to the guard, the fence. But here at Heart Mountain, it turns out that the guards came off of the guard tower after about a year. And as a result of the incidents of a number of shootings, killings by the guards at some of the other camps, in particular the one at Topaz, Utah, where the guard actually shot a prisoner who wasn't even trying to get close to the fence. And as a result, the government quickly made an order to remove the guards, and therefore we felt more comfortable frankly, sneaking out from the fence and going down to the river and enjoying a little bit more freedom. From that point on, now we're talking quite a bit of departure, a difference between the camp here and the concentration camps in Europe. Because in Europe, of course, they had no such freedoms at all. People who are very familiar with definitions of words claim that the U.S. Camps for the Japanese should be properly called concentration camps because we certainly were very well concentrated, and at least for the first year, it was a prison-like condition. And when questioned, I use that term, that it was an American concentration camp. If such an unconstitutional activity could happen, it might happen again. And therefore, everyone should be on their guard on any steps, any move, even discussions of recommending that people be placed into prisons simply because of their beliefs or their background or whatever groups they came from. That is not a reason for denying their rights under the Constitution. And they must remember places like Heart Mountain and other camps where the 120,000 people were denied their constitutional rights.
Next, an interview from Takashi Hochizaki.
I entered into the Pomona Assembly Center. And at that time, I was 16 years old and not really understanding what was really happening. So as time went on, getting the stories of what had happened to the people, especially the farming families, where they lost their crops and a real financial loss, that began to realize what was really happening relative to this being removed from our homes. A couple of years later, when the questionnaire came out, one of the questions was, would I be willing to serve in the armed forces or in the army? The way the question was stated, I said, if I answered yes, would I really then be volunteering? And not knowing exactly the full implication of that question, I answered no. And then for the next question, whether I would affirm my allegiance to the United States, and I answered yes. So I had a no and a yes answer. And apparently, some of the people said that, well, then that would put me into a disloyal individual. However, within the camp, the questions came up for many of the people as to what and how they should be answering those questions. There were several groups, or very early on, really questioning our confinement and whether now the legality of that confinement, whether it was really legal or not. And there was a fellow named Kiyoshi Okamoto who was really pushing the fact that what had happened to us, our constitutional rights were being denied. He called himself the Fair Play Committee of One, pushing the concept that all of this is wrong. And when the draft part came out, the Fair Play Committee moved on to then use the draft as a means of them bringing about and into the courts the question of the constitutional or denial of our constitutional rights. And so the stand there taken was that if our constitutional civil rights are returned, then we would serve in the army. So that was the basis of that we went into the courts. But the unfortunate thing was that during the trial, that particular question was never raised. And the question then was, did you or did you not report for your physical examination? As we were beginning to decide how to have the trial, whether we're going to have a jury trial or leave it just to the judge, the group decided that it would probably be better because we didn't know what the sympathy of the people being on the jury would be, so selected that we would turn it over to the judge instead of having a non-jury trial. But unfortunately, it turned out that we later find out that the judge was a bit of a racist, and during the trial he did call us Japs, and so and it turned out that the judge was not sympathetic at all to our cause.
Lastly, an interview from Margaret Cooper. This one, I think, is highly relevant now, and I think it'll be clear why. As a content warning, she recalls the use of offensive language against her and her family in this interview.
When we went back to California, my father in his used car from Minneapolis and my uncle, we caravaned together. And we were a little apprehensive about how people were going to, you know, treat us in California. So we stopped in Utah or somewhere to eat. And we walked into this little diner. It wasn't a fancy place because, for one thing, we couldn't afford a fancy place. And as we walked in, he came out and said, "We don't serve Japs." And I was so furious. I didn't know what to say. And I said, "And we don't want to be served by people like you." So then we went away. And I don't know how we found something to eat. Well, you know, there were German and Italian prisoner of war camps here. But those were adults and they were soldiers. And they knew that when they served their country, they were going to be fighting and they might get injured or get captured. And that was something that was known to them. The difference is, for us, as 11-year-old or 12-year-old or infants or even adults, they thought, well, they can't do that to us because we're not soldiers. We're just citizens. We're living here. We just happen to look like the enemy, and it's a racial thing. Racial profiling is a big deal now. So racial profiling has been and will be in the future an issue in America. And even though we know it's not politically correct, it does happen. And especially when the economy is bad, that's when racial profiling rears its ugly head. You know, we had relatives that did fight in the war. And when they had leave, many of them came into the camp to visit their relatives. And many people can't believe that these young men would be fighting for the United States while their relatives were incarcerated behind barbed wire. So that goes beyond belief. But so I have sympathy for those young men who refused to go fight for a country that put them behind barbed wire. And they said, and rightly so, "You give us our freedom. You give my family freedom, and I'd gladly fight for you. I'd gladly fight for a country that protects me."
Now, a second part of her interview.
The real low point in our lives was when my brother died at Heart Mountain. He was 11 years old, 18 months younger than me. And this morning we went to visit the hospital where he died. And all that's left there is a chimney. And after he died, they had a funeral. And we have a picture of the coffin that had beautiful flowers on the coffin, but they weren't real flowers. They were made of crepe paper by the inmates. They'd fashioned these beautiful, colorful flowers out of paper and put them on the casket. And my mother did not want to bury him in this godforsaken place, so she had him cremated and brought back to her home in Los Altos, California, and kept his ashes up in the closet until my father passed away. And then my brother opened the box, put a handful of ashes into a handkerchief, folded them up, and put them in my father's pocket. And so when we buried my father, part of Kenny's ashes went with him also. So that was a very low part of my mother's life. Our whole family mourned his loss. And I only understood the full sadness of this event when I had my own children. And when my son turned 11, I thought about my mother, and I thought how sad that must have been for her.
Now we transition away from recorded interviews towards transcribed interviews. The following is a reading of the transcription of an interview with Takashi Moriuchi, originally from Livingston, California. He was 71 at the time of the interview. He passed away in 2010. He was asked by the interviewer if, at the time of the war, his parents and community realized the full extent of the backlash that would occur in the United States against Japanese Americans. His response is as follows. "I don't think anyone ever expected anything like the evacuation would happen. We grew up, all the kids we grew up with, and all the families we had ever grown up with, or my parents had been in contact with. The general feeling was, and it was expressed, that we know you're all right, but that somebody blew something up in the northern end of California or something, which never really happened. But the rumors went around. And the reason for the evacuation was military necessity, but by the time we were evacuated, the Battle of the Coral Sea had already occurred, so the real military reason for our being evacuated was gone by the time we were evacuated. There was no way that the Japanese Imperial forces could ever even reach the United States. Many people are aware that a naval man made a survey of the Japanese-American population, and he came to the conclusion that there would be no acts of sabotage or espionage by Japanese-Americans, as history has proven. Roosevelt didn't want to hear that. It's my thought that he wanted the United States to get into the war anyhow, so he welcomed this almost. Actually, you know, it was 6 months before we were evacuated, and we were told that if we didn't continue farming, we were committing sabotage, so we put in our crops and took care of our crops. But when we were evacuated, we were given 1 week's notice to leave, so there was no way that we could take care of our business affairs and even personal affairs very well. Just imagine leaving with just what you could carry to go into the camps. Later in the interview, Takashi is asked if any one thing in particular helped carry him through his experience in the camps. He answered as follows. I guess that's a hard question to answer. We came through it without... Well, we were too busy working. There wasn't any other thing to do but work. So we did. We just didn't sit back and expect something to happen. I know that, see, when I left camp, I was probably one of the first ones to leave camp. We were cleared by the FBI, and then after we were cleared by the FBI, we were told, now, you good American citizen, go out and work for the war effort. That's one of the things. I thought that was pretty doggone ironic. I felt like giving somebody a good swift kick. But most of us just didn't want to live in the camp conditions. Because we were used to being independent, and in camp, you were not. Next is a reading of a transcribed interview with Sumiko Kobayashi. First, she discusses her experiences living in California prior to the establishment of the camps. When I went to look for a job, I went to this Del Monte packing house and asked for a job. The man looked at me and asked, "How old are you?" And I said I was 17, and he said, "Well, we have no openings on the day shift, but we do have some on the night shift, but you have to be 18. So I had to wait a few weeks until I was 18. It wasn't long. He put me to work when I turned 18 on the night shift. When I went back and told our neighbors, who were Japanese, they were surprised because they said they hadn't heard of any Japanese Americans who were working there. They said, "Oh, we didn't know they accepted Japanese for employment." The job that I'd had at the Del Monte canning factory was taking these peaches as they come down the belt and sticking them on this machine, which peeled them and took the pit out. I think I must have breathed in quite a bit of that peach fuzz, and I think that's what gave me the pleurisy. But the doctor was convinced I had TB, so they put me in this sanitarium, and that's where I was when the war broke out. December 7th, 1941. For Japanese Americans, and I guess for a lot of others, that was a very definitive date. You remember exactly where you were, like you remember when John F. Kennedy was shot. You remember where you were. So I was in this sanitarium in Livermore. My parents were there that day visiting me when one of the other patients, I think, heard it on the radio that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. I guess we weren't immediately at war. There was probably a lapse of a few hours at least before. That happened at 8 a.m. Honolulu time, I guess, And it was later in the day when we got the word on the West Coast. What is it, 3 or 4 hours difference? So, that's how I learned that we were at war. Sumiko then reflects back to an encounter with law enforcement. The local police and the FBI came to visit our family, and they saw this picture of me taken when I was 3 months old, a framed picture, hanging on the wall, and they thought it was the emperor's son. They were ready to confiscate it and take it away. Fortunately, my father spoke enough English that he was able to convince them that, no, it was not the emperor's son, it was his daughter. So we were allowed to keep the picture. Finally, she discusses the beginning of the imprisonment process. We were evacuated. They posted these evacuation notices, area by area. Of course, they couldn't handle everybody, all 120,000 of us at once, so they set up military areas and posted these notices and told us what we could bring. Some of the people had, unfortunately, only about 48 hours. Of course, we knew it was coming, so we were able to sell some of our things, our furniture and things. We didn't have a car to dispose of. But they were really sold at distress prices. We had a refrigerator, I guess, that was sold for $5, which, even when you consider that prices were a lot lower then, was very little money. The vultures descended on us. They knew they could get things at a bargain. In one book, it just said, one lady burned her things rather than give them up at such a low price. My greatest loss? My dog. We couldn't take her along, and she knew something was strange because, of course, all the furniture was gone. She went into her little bed. She would curl up in her bed and whimper, and we'd call her and she wouldn't come out. So we left her in the care of another family, but when we sent for her later, when we were told we could have pets, she had run away. She's probably looking for us. We've now come to the end of the main content for this week. I've done my best to discuss an awful time in U.S. history through the words of those who are subject to its abuses. I would encourage all listeners to go and read the full transcribed interviews on the American Friends Service Committee's website, or to just Google Japanese-American internment interview. There is so much personal testimony out there, testimony that really deserves reading. Here at Lost and Found, we, meaning, me, Marcus, writer and host, I have lots of homework. And as much as I like talking about losing, I don't like feeling like a loser in class. So, the narrative form of the show each week is generally less than an hour, with the rest of the time filled with creative but less, research-intensive content. This week, I'll share yet another set of classical music pieces. However, I'd like to share music written specifically by Japanese composers. There's an abundance of fantastic classical music written by Japanese composers, Chinese composers, but generally, East Asian composers are underrepresented in classical music, especially because the classical music world is biased towards the West. And to some extent, I'm guilty of this as well. Most of the composers whose work I've shared on this podcast have been from Europe and the United States. This first piece is called Woodcutter's Song for Orchestra, composed by Kiyoshige Koyama and performed by the NHK Symphony Orchestra, a professional orchestra based in Tokyo. To me, this piece is interesting because, yes, you can hear the influence of the traditional classical music canon, all those old German dudes. But you can also hear clear traces of traditional Japanese music, especially in the types of scales the composer chose for the middle of the piece. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to play part of a concerto for shakuhachi and orchestra, composed by Ryohei Hirose. The shakuhachi is essentially a traditional Japanese flute, which is traditionally made of bamboo. For those of you music folks out there, the instrument is tuned to the minor pentatonic scale, which is kind of fun. This may be musical sacrilege, but I'm actually going to stop the piece halfway through, simply because the piece is all one movement and 20 minutes long, and I want to get a third composer in here. This is performed by the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra. Hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
This last one is a very cool piece called Marimba Spiritual, composed by Minoru Miki and performed by the trio Xenakis and Othman Luati. This is the second movement.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. I hope you come back next week.